I'm delighted to be here. It's lovely to talk about a project which we were saying is only 4 years old. It feels like it's been going a lot longer than that. But for the past 4 years, well, 5 years, because we had a year of trying to get funding for it before it actually launched, I've been part of the Transcribe Bentham project. I'm here today to talk about the project. I should say right off the bat, it's a large team. I'm not the only person doing it. Like a lot of digital humanities projects, it's very collaborative. And so I am but a small cog in quite a large wheel, and we'll go over some of those wheels as we go through. This is Bentham. Bentham, meet Oxford. Oxford, meet Bentham. We have his head in a box in one of the archives, actually in a cupboard in the archaeology department. I'm not allowed to tell you where it is. But smells a bit like beef jerky. Doesn't come out too much these days because his head's actually falling to bits. Why do we have his head? Well, he's not the founder of University College London, but he certainly was the person behind why it got founded. He had a circle of people around him who took up his ideas about egalitarianism and the fact that everyone should be able to be educated no matter if they were a woman or a man or whatever religion they believed in. He didn't believe in any religion. UCL doesn't have a theology department to this day because he didn't believe that God should have a place within the university. So at the time, there was King's, there was Oxford, and he decided that there should be another university in London that was open to anybody who could afford to attend, and UCL was founded based on his principles. He was a jurist, he was a philosopher. He is behind a lot of core ideas about our modern society. He helped set up the legal statutes for the United States, for Australia. He helped stop the convicts being transported to Australia. He wrote papers on women's rights. He wrote papers on animals' rights. He wrote a lot of papers. He wrote a lot of stuff. We have a lot of these things at University College London in the special collections. We have 60,000 folios of his handwriting. There's another 30,000 folios that are held in the British Library, and those are his life's work, his jottings. A lot of things have never been studied before, a lot of things have never been made available before. 40,000 of those at the start of this project were untranscribed, uncatalogued and untranscribed, so we didn't know what was in them. And of course, we also have his body. Why do we have his body? This was a giant two fingers up to people that believed that you had to get buried to, you know, fulfil some relationship with some non-existent god. So when he died, he asked for his body to be taken apart for medical science, and then for his bones to be dressed up in his favourite clothes with some favourite accoutrements. This is his walking stick called Dapple, which he wanted to be put in a box and on display. He was, for a while, on display in his best friend's house, and then he came to University College London, where he's been in the corridor ever since, in the main quad, and you can go and see him. He's open during the day. He gets tucked up at night time to go to sleep. There are some myths that surround him, like he goes to Senate meetings once a year and is present but not voting. That happened last year. The Provost retired after 10 years and he actually wheeled Jeremy in so he could sit at the Provost's last meeting and be present not voting. There's some things to say about this. It's a sense of humour that permeates the university that I'm in, this kind of attitude. And this has permeated a lot of the work that we do, is kind of come and have a go stuff, really. It's a little bit cheeky, it's a little bit intelligent, it's a little bit playful. And we're encouraged to kind of follow that type of research and do that kind of thing. And it's within that spirit that we decided to do a lot of work and a lot of playfulness with Jeremy's work. Oops, what have I done? Oh, here, so this should be an animation of some of his manuscripts. Is it going to start? So we have some images of these manuscripts which don't seem to be coming up. But there we go. They all came out once. They were supposed to all fade in nicely. So I started with some easy ones, and this has ended up on the most tricky ones. This is the kind of stuff we're dealing with. So we have stuff that's very clearly written, and then we have stuff that gets messier and messier as he gets older. His handwriting gets really, really bad towards when he's in his 80s. We have stuff like this. Try and transcribe that, like, and try and put that through a computer to transcribe. It's not going to happen. We've got crossing out, we've got deletions, we've got insertions. You know, the whole thing's very tricky archival material. Transcribing that needs a certain lot of guidelines and an understanding of the content. So we're faced with this massive archive. We want to transcribe it, and we want to deal with the really difficult stuff too. Now, UCL realised that at the end of the 1950s that Bentham was important enough that he should have a project devoted to him. So there's been a centrally funded project called the Bentham Project, which existed in the Faculty of Laws at UCL, because a lot of his stuff is about legal in nature. And so since 1959, they have aimed to produce a new scholarly edition of the works and correspondence of Jeremy Bentham, and they've published 26 volumes so far. They think there's another 50 or so to go. It took 50 years for them to transcribe 20,000 bits of paper. So within 50 years, they managed 20,000 transcriptions of 20,000 documents. So you can work out that it takes a long time for scholars to tackle this stuff and transcribe it. There had been one previous AHRC grant, which was for someone to look through the boxes that were held in special collections and just come up with some things about dates, headings, how many pages of stuff were in there. So there was a little bit of scoping work that was being done. So we knew where some of the interesting stuff was. This stuff's about Australia. This stuff's about sex. You know a lot about sex. This and the ethics of sex. This stuff is about women's rights. This stuff's about animal rights. So we knew where some things were in the collection, but actually we didn't know the content of the things themselves. At the same time, we had a meeting to talk about this, like what we're going to do with the Bentham stuff, and that was convened in the library. Martin Moyles, the digital library manager, convened us all to go, we should have a talk, what we're going to do with this. And at the time, the NP's expenses scandal had just broken in the news in the UK, and the Guardian newspaper had launched a crowdsourcing activity where they put up the PDFs of all the expenses from the MPs and they asked the readership to sort through and to try and spot if the MPs had bought anything that they shouldn't have been buying. I just picked one MP here. He's not guilty of anything that I know of. He was just the person that I clicked on to grab the screenshot. I'm sorry, Labour MP for Kilmarnock and Loud. I'm sure you're innocent of anything. But within the first 80 hours in 2009, 20,000 volunteers had read 170,000 pages. Right? So within the first 3 or 4 days of this, they'd sorted through 170,000 pages of stuff. By the end of 2013, there was only another few volunteers, another 8,000. So within 4 years, they hadn't got very many more people. And there's only a slight increase. So there's this massive surge at first, and then it hasn't carried on. And actually, I was looking for this the other day when I was preparing this talk, and I can't find the crowdsourcing thing anymore. I can't find this online. I think the Guardian might have actually taken it down. So it never completed the whole lot, but they did get through nearly half of the content that they wanted to look at, and they did find some things which have then gone on to be reported and prosecuted. We thought this was a really interesting model, and that's when the word crowdsourcing came into this meeting. Could we use crowdsourcing then to ask for help to transcribe these things? If we put them online and if we digitise them, could we ask for help to transcribe them? And at the time, 4 years ago, this was a really relatively new concept within libraries, archives, and museums, asking people for help using internet technologies in this way. If I'm being absolutely honest, our prime reason for undertaking this was to get the manuscripts digitized in the first place. We couldn't afford digitization because the funding streams had all changed. But there was a funding call that came out which allowed experimental whatever. And so we thought, if we digitize it and we do this experiment of crowdsourcing stuff on the side, whatever happens, even if the crowdsourcing fails, we will get all the manuscripts digitized and we can put them in our library catalogue. And then we have this very interesting information studies project on the side, which is, can crowdsourcing work within a scholarly academic environment? Can we ask people to do the stuff which previously it was people with a PhD in Bentham studies that were doing? Can they do it successfully? And can they do it to best practice guidelines? So we're not just asking people to type in anything. We're asking them to use TEI compliant XML. I'll come back to that in a minute. Following transcription guidelines to generate the type of transcripts that other scholars want. We're not going for the easy stuff. We're bang right in there. Here's some difficult manuscripts that have been crossed out. Here are the guidelines. Off you go. It's an interesting question, right? And a brave one. We're looking back on it. I thought, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it right. And we're going to ask to see if we can get people to do it properly. It's a big team behind this. So Philip Schofield, he's the person who's the PI on this, and he directs the Bentham Project, has done for the last 20 years. And between us, we have people from Digital Humanities, people from the library, we have a couple of research associates, we have the person who's done all the digitization and managing the photography services. And then we have another project, which will come to later, the whole transcriptorium team. So we actually have about 20 people working on this stuff now. perhaps 1 or 2 hours a week. It's Tim Cosser, the RA, who drives a lot of the behind the scenes stuff. So we have one full-time RA, but the rest of the time it's a lot of consultation, a lot of negotiation with different people across UCL and University of London Computing Centre we went to for our, when we built the interface. This is Tony, he's digitising the Bentham manuscripts as they come out of store. So we had a little set up within the digitisation services and we did the digitisation in-house. We now have a bespoke digitisation place. So this is against anyone who knows anything about digitisation, because there's a glass wall there, look at the light you're letting in. But most digitisation, you do it where you have the space and you have the resources to do it. So this is where we actually took a lot of the photographs. Now we have a full digitisation studio at UCL. And that's partly to do with the success of this project leads on to people trusting us to get the infrastructure for other things within college, and I'll come back to that later. So here we have it. This is the Transcribe Bentham Transcription Desk. If it looks familiar, that's because it's built on top of MediaWiki. So it just looks a little bit like Wikipedia, and it functions like Wikipedia. We only had a year for that first project. So we had 3 months of setup time, then 6 months of launch, and then 3 months of reporting time. So when the grant started, we had 3 months to digitize manuscripts, build a transcription interface, and launch, right? 12 weeks. That's a pretty aggressive schedule. So we went with a platform that's already available and we wrote some plugins for it. There's some benefits to that too. MediaWiki is a free install. That means if anybody else wants to install what we've done, they can take it, they can take the bolt-ons that we programmed and we made available for free as well, and they can actually launch their own transcription program using MediaWiki for free. So there have been some benefits for it. There is some drawbacks. It is a bit, there's some, you know, if we're using Wikipedia, there's some things which are not great about it for this, but this, at the time it was the best choice, and it remains a very successful choice. People know how to navigate around and how to deal with this stuff. So here's an example. You ask for a document that's never been transcribed before, you get the image, there's a viewer here that means you can zoom right in, and you start typing. This page has not been transcribed yet, but you can start typing. If I can point, there's some buttons along the top there. Those are buttons which allow you to put things in, like insertions, deletions, names, places. And you know, we came up with these 10 buttons that when you press it, it gives you the tags for TEI compliant XML. Now that's a standard that has been used for document encoding in the digital humanities for about 20 years or so, which means that when we spit out this, it's then reusable. We can say, find all the documents with this date, find all the documents that name this person, find all the documents that gives deletions and additions, that kind of thing. You don't have to use these if you're a user. You don't have to put in the XML, you don't have to put in the tags. We didn't say that anyone had to do it. We kind of put them in there and gave a tutorial on how to do it. But the people that kept coming back to the website picked it up quite quickly. So here we have a thing. We're in the digital humanities. You have to use these best practice guidelines you're supposed to know about TEI compliant XML. They're very hard and all that. And then we put them on a website with some buttons and a couple of video tutorials, and bam, there you go. The volunteers are off using it. We've taught them XML without saying to them, we are teaching you XML. You know, we're teaching them the basics of how to do encoding. We're teaching them the basics of document encoding and transcription. So that's been quite interesting. The majority of volunteers use TEI. They don't know it's TEI, or they do eventually if they want to look at it, but you know, we don't say they have to, and they've learned TEI. So here we have that document which has actually been transcribed. You can see that there are additions, there are line breaks, there are the tags all the way through. So that means when we put this into our library catalogue, it becomes fully searchable on various different terms. Some examples. This is when he first met the woman who he got engaged to. He never married her because his father did not approve, but it's a story about meeting her at a party and they have a fight, and he's like, I like the cut of her jib, because, you know, she's so argumentative, and then they go off into the night, and then he's like, yes, I shall pursue her. So, you know, we found very interesting things about his life through this, and answers that the historians didn't quite know about his recollections. But my favourite one is from Off the Principles of Human Action, and I'll blow this up a little bit so we can read it. And this, we didn't know where his thing about animal rights came from. Why was he interested in the rights of animals? He's one of the first people to write about the ethics of how you treat animals and the rights of animals and how they should have some legal standing. And this is a story when I was about 4 or 5 years old, when one evening I took it into my head to amuse myself with putting earwigs in the candle. I had no malice to the earwigs, poor insects. For my disgust at them, if I had conceived any, would have led me rather to have avoided them than to have handled them in that matter. But the writhings of their bodies, added to the little explosions made by the moisture of their juices, composed a scene which amused my curiosity. A servant who had the charge of me asked what I thought the earwigs must suffer and what I could have to say for myself if anyone that was stronger than I should wish to serve me in the same manner. Now, I have got small children who are in the age of 4. I have this conversation all the time. How would you like it if I picked you up and stamped on you? When one of my youngest stamped on a worm the other day and I had exactly that conversation, right? And so it's really interesting that he's a childhood recollection that goes on to inform his thinking and then goes into legal practice. So things like that emerge, which are an insight into his past, into his personality, and into I'm going to go off on one and I shouldn't, but there's interesting things. He had a pet bear. There's other stories that emerge where his servants were looking after him and on the Halloween they all dressed up as ghosts and chased him around the house and he was petrified. You know, things like that come out. So it's really fascinating insight to Bentham as a person and how he grew up in this slightly strange creative environment which led him perhaps to be the way he was and to produce it. Good. So how does it work then? This is the kind of flowchart of the workflow of what happens when we put a manuscript online. We put the manuscript up, people transcribe it, then they press the button, they submit it back to us. And we say, is the transcript of the required standard? So we have Tim, who drives the transcription desk, who has a PhD in Bentham Studies, who knows what to expect from these documents, who double checks both the content of the manuscript plus the encoding plus the XML to make sure that it's right. And if it is right, then yes, it gets locked. The progress bars get updated, so we have progress bars on the site to see how many things are. And the user gets a thank you, you have submitted to this. And then we convert it to pure XML and we upload it to UCL Digital Collection in the library. So that's the best case scenario, we've done it perfectly. And actually most users get to that stage now because they use it quite a lot. And about 70 or 80%, we'll come to some stats in a minute, of the manuscripts submitted go straight, they're fine, they go straight into the collection. But if they aren't, then the documents are unlocked, it goes back into the website and is asked for improvement by someone else. It turns out that most users want to touch stuff that no one else has touched, actually. So they don't want to be fixing up half-done jobs of other people. They want to be seeing stuff no one else has done before, doing new stuff. And that's where, when there's any downtime, someone else like Tim can tinker and fix up some of the things that have been submitted that are not quite right. And then we go into UCL Library. So this is, you can search for, this is Miss Letty. So you can do like the equivalent of a Google search, but in their catalogue, search for Miss Letty, and bam, here it is, it pulls up the documents. So you can now find documents that you wouldn't otherwise be able to find. Some other things to mark. We thought when we launched this that we'd have a user forum and everyone would be hanging out there and talking to each other and saying, isn't this an interesting example? What do you think? And, you know, communities would form, groups, lifelong friendships, marriages perhaps. No. No. Nobody uses the user forum. And various other crowdsourcing projects have user forums, some of which are successful, some of which aren't. And I think it depends very much on the nature of the task. A lot of the users spend a couple of hours per manuscript, and I think they're coming on the website to do a solitary thing. They're not there to hang out. They're not there really to compete with other people. It's another thing about crowdsourcing, whether you can have leaderboards and compete with people. They're not really that bothered about that. So this is quite a difficult task, it's a full-on task, it's one that takes them quite a lot of time, and the social element of it, not so much. They integrate on Facebook and on Twitter, and we talk to some people through that, but they're not so interested in the forums. And I should say as well, if anyone's listening, the volunteers themselves are the reason why this project has been successful. The dedication of some of the volunteers, we'll come to that in a minute, is amazing. The amount of time they have spent on the site to help us write these transcripts, and we are entirely dependent on them. So we are learning about what's best for them and what environment we have to give to them. And if they don't want a social environment, there's no point in us developing any more tools to help them or to try and corral them down that way. We just have to go, no, that didn't work, let's move on. So some facts and figures, this is of a couple of weeks ago. There were 10,800 manuscripts transcribed. That's now past 11,000. We passed 11,000 mark last week. And you think, well, that's not that much, is it, 11,000? But if each document has about 2,500 words, we're over 3 million words now of volunteer transcription labour from 4 years. 3 million words, that's quite a lot. 91% of those have been checked and accepted, so 9% are waiting for someone else to come in along and fix them up that weren't quite right. We have had 60,000 visits in the last 4 years from 24,000 unique visitors. Of those, we'll come to a minute how many of that was, people are on average on the website for 12 minutes. So they come to the website to do work, right? You don't poke around on a website for 12 minutes unless you're interested in it. 131 countries, so it's a worldwide phenomenon. We're involving people from all over the world in this. But only 440 people have actually transcribed something. So of those 4,500, only 440 people created an account, logged in and tried it. And of those, only about 200 have come back. So it actually is like, oh, this is cool. Actually, this is hard work. Actually, this is really hard work. And most of the work has been done by a core of 25 super transcribers. So when we launched this, we thought we would get, like the MP scandal, we thought we would have a large surge of people coming to look at this stuff, and we'd get 100,000 users sign up in the first 24 hours. Everyone would do one document, we'd get half of the stuff done, bam, there you go. But actually, what we wanted to find was these 25 people who, for want of a better word, have become obsessed with this project. And I have no problem with obsession. Like most academics, I have an obsessive tendency. That's absolutely fine. And so they come back, and they look at this site, and they want to contribute to the site, and they are dedicated. And that's actually who we wanted to find through the crowdsourcing. We wanted to find the 25 dedicated people worldwide who would come back again and again and again for whatever reasons. And we're doing a study with them just now, asking them why? And there's a variety of reasons for that. And for some of them, there's a lot of people who are retired, who are people like history teachers or a headmistress, or, you know, want to be intellectually active and don't want to sit down every evening and watch EastEnders. Someone said this to us, you know, rather than watching EastEnders for half an hour, come after my dinner, I sit down with the transcribe anthem and I transcribe a page. Like, isn't that brilliant? There's some other people who are ill and can't leave the house. There's some people going through messy divorces and things like that, and they have this kind of constant where they can contribute online, doing something which is intellectually stimulating to them. So that's fascinating to see why people are interested in contributing a massive amount of time. On average, we get 51 transcripts per week. However, that is more than doubled since the start of 2014. And that was when the British Library transcripts went online. So we've digitised the stuff at the British Library now as well. And when that online went online, there was another rollout of publicity for the project. And we got a whole new group of people coming in. And we've now doubled the amount of manuscripts per week. And since March 2014, 133 transcriptions per week are coming in. So if we think back to the stats of the historians looking at the documents themselves, they could do maybe one a day. An RA could do one a day, so five transcripts a week. And we are now at 133 transcripts per week for the same amount of pay for the one RA who's driving this. So we have now scaled up quite massively. It took us some time to get there. The biggest number of transcripts in any week was 300 in 1 week in June. I don't think we quite know why. But it was great, right? We're not complaining. Brilliant. This is our leader chart of people who have contributed. So the ones in red have stopped contributing. And that's another research question, right? Why did they come and do 106 transcripts and work on four manuscripts a week and then just disappear? So getting in touch with them and going, what was it about that you wanted to come for, you know, 6 months and do this every day and then suddenly you didn't do it anymore? So there are interesting questions there. We have people who have joined quite recently. So Chris Riley joined quite recently and has done over 1,000 manuscripts since the 12th of May. Right? which is 93 a week, which is climbing up the leaderboard to our all-time star, Diane Folan, who has done 1,198 herself. So, and that's, she's been there right from the start. So we have an interesting relationship, sometimes ongoing, sometimes kind of like a supernova, we're here, they do lots of stuff, sometimes, you know, there are different things happening. Diane has come along to some events that we've had in London. Some of them come, we invite them. We have a relationship. Tim emails these people almost on a daily basis. It becomes a relationship. And this is sometimes often forgotten with digital systems. It's a very arm's length, you're talking to a computer. But with this, there is a relationship with the RA and treating your transcribers with respect and saying, well, thank you, you know, and engaging them, inviting them to things. We sent them a mug last year. It's a present. Here you go. Oh, thank you for your super transcription. Here you go, bent the mug. You know, just out of the blue. And they're all delighted by that. So it's just about having a relationship with these people and keeping up with it. It's been incredibly important for us, and these people are an incredibly important relationship to us. Another thing that we do, by the way, how long do you want me to talk for? And ask. How long have I got till?
You've got as long as you want.
Okay. One of the things, so just to explain, the first year of funding that we had was from the HRC. So we had this, we launched it. We thought we'd have 6 months and we'd go, oh, isn't that interesting? And that would be the end of it. We've got all the things digitized that we want. But then it was a big success. And then we go, now we need to find follow-on funding for a digital project. And we applied again to the HRC and they told us, even though we'd been successful, even though we'd been on the front cover of the New York Times, even though we'd been on the BBC Six News, all of that, they wouldn't fund us again because it wasn't new anymore. Mm. Oh, yeah. So, yes, I hope you've listened to that. So they wouldn't fund us again. So then we're left in a situation of what do? We've got a high profile project and we've won a couple of prizes. It won the Pre-Arts Electronica, like a big digital arts prize, and we have to shut it down. UCL came to our aid and they kept the RA on a couple of days a week while we still applied for other funding. And then Mellon swanned in on their big white horse and gave us funding for another 3 or 4 years. But no, sorry, another 2 years with a bit of an extension. But that's coming to an end now. So in the first tranche of the project, we just did that kind of launch it, see what happens, and we had a bit of fallow time. Now in the second tranche, that's when we got the British Library manuscripts digitised. But as part of the Mellon bid, we had to keep very, very careful records of what was coming in, what was going out. So Tim, bless him, timed how long it took him to do the corrections and everything from various people. So now we have all these charts and all these databases about how much time he spent correcting them, what the economics of it was. And we're actually just doing a paper just now with the business studies people here about business flow of this and the timing of what these graphs of like how people improve over time and how wonderful it is from, you know, these are the kind of things that once you gather data, you can play with. Going back into the topic of the seminar. So you've gathered all this data, you have a large data set that you can then extrapolate things about your chosen from. So here are some of our stats. It takes an average of 201 seconds to check a manuscript. Bless him, he really was timing himself to doing all these things constantly. So the first iteration, it takes 4 alterations to the text, but then that's reduced as the encoder gets better to 2 alterations to the text. 247 hours of Tim's time was spent checking submissions over a time period, so really he has been clocking everything that he's been doing to see what the mechanics of behind the scenes are. This is a graph of the very early days of the launch of the project. In 2010, so we launched right about this time of year actually in 2010, and there's a massive spike here. Now this is Boxing Day, and what happened on Boxing Day was we got featured in the New York Times. So what happened was lots of people signed up to start transcribing, which yay is brilliant, but no it's not brilliant because everyone in the university system in the UK is on holiday then. So we had like 1,000 people sign up and like no one was there to answer the email. This was a bit of a problem because then very few people came back after a few days when we actually went, I'm sorry, we're all on holiday then. So, but this is also interesting to show that the outreach that we did could not only be digital. There was a lot of physical outreach. Prints and magazines in the history, BBC History Magazine, University of the Third Age, the radio, we were on the radio a couple of times. And whenever we were mentioned in a physical print thing, you could see the users jump. So it's not just about this being a digital thing, it's we're trying to find the right sort of people by whatever it means, and there's still an interesting relationship to old school media to try and find these people in the first place. this is the graph now. So when you go back, you can't even see that jump now. That's it there. And we've constantly been attracting new users, and we've constantly been going new manuscripts. You can see towards the end, it's speeded up when the British Library stuff was added as well, and we have all these new people. So this is about volunteer motivations. Why do people want to come and help us? A lot of them said that they have a primary interest in the subject. They are interested in history, they're interested in philosophy, they want to contribute. The next popular one was they were interested in the technology of crowdsourcing, and also they're interested in of doing something and collaborating and joining something and giving their material to that. Very few people say they're actually interested in Ben. I'm just saying that about the famousness of this project. In some ways, Bentham, to us, he's a huge figure because he's the totemic figure. His body sits in the box in the hall, right? And that's the first place everyone goes to visit. Have you seen Bentham? We wheel him into meetings. So it's this kind of, we have this relationship with him. But actually, outside UCL, for a lot of places, he's not really known very well. And there are other historical figures that could have been launched or could have been used for a crowdsourcing thing, and that would have been more famous. We got there first. Right? We got there first, like, we're going to do this big crowdsourcing thing and we're going to do it on this bunch of manuscripts. It has changed the relationship we have with Bentham, and I'll show you some slides towards at the end, but actually it's not necessarily about Bentham itself, it's more about history, it's more about philosophy, it's more about that this is the project that you can do if you're interested in that. Interestingly, very few people are doing it for the recognition or the competition, they're doing it to collaborate, to give something back, which is really nice. Why don't people want to take part? So this is something that we follow up if people drop off the radar. Money, they said, and it's, when was money ever mentioned in this? But then there are interesting ethical questions about the money behind this. So when they submit the manuscript to us, it becomes copyright UCL. So they do the transcription and they send it into us, and it becomes copyright UCL. So we will have to walk a thin line, or fine line, of making sure we always recognise the volunteer labour, and we are now giving away all the manuscript images and the transcripts on a CC BY licence, but at the same time there are issues about copyright and ownership and labour, and we're not paying for this. There's issues in crowdsourcing about the ethics of using crowdsourcing within the library, archive, museum community. Especially when people start paying for it. Some places are starting to use things like Mechanical Turk. You pay people very, very little to do this kind of stuff. We wouldn't do that. We don't necessarily want third world poverty involved in our scholarly projects. But you know, there are tricky issues that we have to talk through about what it means to be using the internet to disseminate labour across a wide area. Okay, that was a bit of a rant. Why else do people leave? The complexity of the instructions, lack of time. It's actually really time consuming to transcribe one of these documents. It takes 2 or 3 hours. It's not as easy as all that. Very few people leave because of the text encoding. Again, we said that that's not a reason why. Bentham's handwriting, it gets a bit difficult towards the end. But we can choose. We have divided his handwriting up into easy, difficult, hard, so people can choose what they want to do. This again is from Tim's magical database of everything he does. We put a new system in place, so with the funding from Mellon, we slightly improved the interface to allow people to do things a little bit easier. And he can show that over time, people are submitting stuff. If they only submit one, then there's a lot of corrections that get needed. But as they submit more and more, so this is the people that submit a lot of manuscripts. He doesn't need to correct their stuff. They get used to it and they depend. We'd expect that, right? Practice makes perfect. So these are the super users, are all the people down here that they come in and it takes Tim a couple of seconds to look over the stuff and put it into the database. Now we get into conversations about where we go next. So between 1984 and 2010, we produced 28,000 transcripts. That's before Transcribe Bentham started. And if it was going at the same rate, the Bentham project would take up to 2081 to finish the transcripts, right? That's how long it would take. But since we've launched, volunteers have worked on 2,500 transcripts per year, so at this current space it's going to take 27 years using Transcribe Bentham to finish that, which is an improvement. But if people keep going as they have been since the start of 2014, when we got more people, then we could do the entire collection within a decade, so within 10 years. And that's really exciting, right? So we've speeded up the process by a factor of 10. There's some issues though. Will our Wikipedia plugin still be working in 10 years' time? Probably not. So we have sustainability issues about upkeep of our system. And we are coming to the end now of our Mellon grant, and now we're no longer new, we're an established project. We have to try and keep it going for the next 10 years if we want to finish. We need to pay for someone to look after the back end. We need to have people help and support the computing front end, and we have to make sure that the whole thing doesn't fall over and disappear. I haven't talked about backups. We have all, everything's backed up. So we have, if it did, we have the backups of the transcripts, we have the backups of the images. But at the same time, you know, we're in a bit of a sticky situation now, and we're hitting what a lot of digital projects hit, which is the sustainability issue and how do you keep it going, especially since this is predicated on the fact that we have an RA behind the scenes making sure that the quality is high. So we can talk about the cash, we can talk about how expensive it is to do this kind of thing. Our first funding was $262,000 for that 1 year project, and a lot of it was spent on digitisation, a lot of it was spent on staff costs, so a third of it was spent on the staff costs, and still the major cost is staffing. Where do we go from that? We are now at the point where we are churning out so many more transcripts than an RA could. When we first started this, a year on, it would have been cheaper just to employ two RAs with that money and do it for a couple of years. But now we've hit that economic thing with this big startup cost, and now we've hit that place where we're producing much more than we would have if we'd spent the same money, but we've got to keep it going, and now we don't have funding to do that. So we're in discussions with various funders at the moment to see whether or not we can get someone to keep this going, because we've got a high profile project. We can't just pull the plug on it now. It would be highly embarrassing for UCL, it'd be highly embarrassing for you know, there are issues, there's lots of issues there that we are working through, as is the nature of the project. So yeah, that was, at first we thought two full-time research associates could have transcribed 5,000 manuscripts between them in the first year, which is about how many we did, and it would have cost £100,000. So for half the money we could have done that work, but now, down the line, we're doing much more transcriptions. This is a worldwide outreach project, really. These are the users who have logged in and transcribed something. So we can see that we are taking the UCL brand, and I didn't realise we were doing this, it's a bit naive about that. It's about taking the UCL brand out there and doing something as well. And it's a flagship project for UCL and kind of delivering it worldwide. Talking about reuse, putting the stuff up on GitHub so you can download the Wikipedia plugins. It has been used by two or three different places now. So we have the National Archive, the Victoria Archive in Australia have used it for their transcription. The Munch Archive in Oslo use it as the basis for transcription of Munch's letters. The toolbar has been used in the letters of 1914 over in Dublin, so bits of the system are being reused. It's incredibly rare within the digital humanities to have code reuse, actually, to write something and develop a system and go, yeah, you can go and take it and do it, but actually have someone else going, right, I've taken your whole thing, I've plugged it all in and I'm ready to go. That's incredibly rare, so we're really proud that this has been reused successfully by other projects. And then we get on to Transcriptorium, because what we didn't realise, and we didn't think about this, if you've got 3 million words of transcribed text, and if you've got these images, and they work very nicely together, and they've been checked by someone who knows their stuff technically and who knows their stuff about the context, what you have then is a ground truth database which can be used on an artificial intelligence machine learning thing to train computers how to read handwriting. We didn't think about that. So, for the last 2 years, we've been part of an EC Framework 7 funded project called Transcriptorium, which is a massive collaborative project, as these big Framework 7 projects are, between people all over Europe, and we've been developing handwriting recognition technology. If you want to read more about it, we do have a website which has a variety of things, but I thought I would try and have a go. There's some stuff online now. and shall we see if it works? It might not work because this is in complete development. Like every day, the code is actually changing now. Let me see if I can. Is it injected into it before the internet explodes? Okay, so here we have some of the Bendeley things. So we're going to sort the pages by difficulty. We'll start with the really easy stuff. So this is live, this is actually happening. We're waiting for an image to load. Here we go, it's going to contact the engine to actually read it. So we've got an image here that has some text. And if I click on that, it goes and tries to read it. There we go. Default such a your device is Bendeley, yeah, that's what it says. And what you can do, if you find a mistake, you can correct this, and then you save it, and it then saves the transcription. So we go through the document line by line, and we can make sure that it's actually, we're getting accuracy of 96% of Bendeley's manuscripts now. We're working with 5 or 6 major languages and archives. I had a chat today about using some Bodleian stuff on this and putting it through. And what we think this is going to be used for, you won't necessarily be able to see the OCR of the manuscript, but just like in Google Books where you search and it comes up, oh, this word appears on that page. For manuscript images, can you imagine finding anything that says exhibit? Bam, there you go. And it'll bring up, if it gets a 96% right on that, on all the Digitrans content across the whole of Europe, yeah. Yay! You know, so this is actually very transformative. There's some problems when you go into the really tricky stuff. Like, so let's have a look at this one where it's been crossed out. It works. So you can see that's made a mistake, rendering such fatigue, such fogs. But at the same time, then that's when we could go in here and say it's fatiguing. And it goes on to the next line and saves it in the database. And then whenever anyone corrects it as well, that's correcting the machine learning, and it's a feedback loop. So we will then be moving with transcribed Bentham within the next month. We're a little bit behind the schedule. But within the next month, we will be putting up a version of transcribed Bentham which has the stuff pre-filled in and asking people to do OCR correction on that. And one of the questions is, will our users like that? Or will they hate it? And if they hate it, then we turn it right off because we do not want to upset these 25 people. If they say no, this is not for me, I actually like working through it myself, then we get rid of it. But so we're at the stage and we are testing this stuff, we're almost alpha beta testing it, we're putting stuff up and we're getting the response from our users and we're trying to work with them in ways which are exciting. That's so exciting. So exciting to be a small part of that project. Yes, so here we are again. That was just a screenshot in case it didn't work, the live demo, because as I say, we are actually working on the code behind the scenes as we go, and it is this only went live a few weeks ago to allow people to have a play with it. There we go, some more examples. So just to kind of think some final thoughts about what this project has meant for us, what we didn't realise is this was the first project that UCL Centre for Digital Humanities was really involved in. UCLDH will be 5 in May, and Transcribed Bentham will be 5 in September. So this is the first real big project that we had funded, and it's the first really big successful high profile project that we did. And if I want to be smart, I'll look back at it and go, well, this is so strategic of us to get involved in something like this. But absolutely not. It was strategic because what that did was put our mark at UCL. When people go, what's digital humanities? It's a question we get all the time. What's digital humanities about? We now have something that we can point at and go, well, oh, right, and they do this, and they transcribe, and it's like a lie, they digitise, they try and do it. And, there's a whole series of stuff that's attached to it. People kind of get the space that we're hanging out in. And because we launched something, or we were involved in the launch of something which is successful, it means that people then go, oh, but you're the people that transcribe them. And doors have opened for us, and we have the support of college in a way that wouldn't have happened had we not had this high profile project, which everyone kind of knows about. So when I give a little talk to centres for digital humanities are just starting up. But my first thing is go to your special collections, go to your museum. What have you got that no one else has? What project can you do that's institutionally important? Because you need to get the support of your institution, because you need to get a phone call, can you spend £100,000 by Friday? Yes, yes I can. You need to be on that list, they need to respect you, right? So it's part of that, and that's been hugely important for UCLDH. As I say, we've only been around for 4.5 years, slightly older than the end, but that, having that as a big success has opened a lot of doors for us within college, never mind elsewhere. And the other thing to say is, we then were involved with a variety of things around Bentham that we didn't expect to get involved in. So he used to have a little rack of leaflets outside them, which were terribly out of date. You know, we put in a nice touch screen, we could learn all about them, and we could see his head. His head, by the way, is no longer in between his legs, just sitting at his feet. But in the 1970s, it got stolen by students from King's College who kicked it around the quad. And so since then, it's not been out on display. So this is the closest you can get to it. It's like a high resolution image of it right next to the box. And we were involved in helping put everything together. And it's been part of the whole project has put the spotlight back on Bentham. It's put the spotlight on how important he is to us as an institution. And it's really raised his name within a whole lot of historical studies again, because it's saying, well, this big flagship project in this slightly different area of history and online communication is, you know, it's Bentham's project. I like to think he would be really pleased with this. He does have a quote in one of his manuscripts about many hands making light work, merry hands make merry work, he says. And, you know, it's part of his ethos almost, to be open, to be collaborative, to be talking to people. So we like to think that, you know, this is carrying on that kind of spirit. It's been absolutely fascinating working with him. I've had great fun. It's kind of transformed in a way our attitude towards Bentham himself, like physically himself. This openness around Bentham. He comes out of his box once a year, and last year to get cleaned, beetles always eat through his pants. Anyway, he came out of his box, and it used to be like a thing that curators would just do and they'd peel them into a room. And last year we made it public, we made it open, we started talking about it on Facebook, we started talking about it on Twitter, we're saying, Bentham's coming out of his box, come and have a look. 300 people queued up to see him be cleaned. And it's this issue about openness and transparency, and you know, it comes not just about the document stand, it's about the man himself and about some of the myths that's around the man as well. Transcribe Bentham, made you. Very pleased with it. If you came to, that was my idea. It's like, yeah, we should do it. And then Chris Grinner and I, he can kind of put it together. But it's something we want people to be involved in. If you can think of people, especially students, we've had very low take up, especially from high school students and students, of getting involved with this kind of thing. But if you can recommend it to anyone, please do, because we're always looking for these new super transcribers. But I just have to say a final thanks to all the core people who are involved in this project now, and the volunteers, because without the volunteers, or the volunteers, as some people are calling them now, without the volunteers, we wouldn't be able to do this project. The Transcribe Bentham really needs these people to give up their time, give up their energy, and give up their expertise on Bentham to make sure that this works. Thank you very much.